traveled out, dropped our mine, and we were being peckered by a flak. And the pilot did some evasive action. He claims he hit the water. I think we hit the superstructure of the flak ship. But anyway, what we did was we took the prop off on the left on the port side. We had stubs about this long remaining. And we had to get back home. We couldn't get any altitude. But we got up, I guess, maybe probably about 2,500 feet or something like that. So I headed for the nearest point of land, and we landed at Torquay. But we had to come in hot because we, you know, we'd drop out of the goddamn sky, so we had to come in with
one engine going full bore.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. At an excessive airspeed. Mm-hmm. So we overran the runway and tipped it on its nose in the ditch at the end.
You sound like an expensive crew for the war effort, I tell you.
We went through a lot of aircraft.
Yeah, gosh.
But we, the pilot got a DSC, immediate DSC on that trip, and rightly so. And then he got another one on the Hamburg dude, where he got a DFC and bar out of it, and I had a DFC. we were the first crew to finish a tour of operations from 428 Squadron. And in that time, we calculated that we actually went through two squadrons of personnel. In other words, our loss rate was that high. As a result, the 428 squadron is known as the Ghost Squadron.
Oh, really?
We took the ghost as our crest. And I was involved in the development of the squadron crest. I'm no artist. What it finally became. We finished our tour of operations in August, September of 1943. So all of this happened between February of 43 and August, September.
A tour was how many flights?
30 flights.
30 flights, yeah.
Not many got through during that. It was the most intense period.
How many original
fighting for Bomber Command?
How many original crews were left of this squadron?
We were the only original complete crew left.
Mm-hmm.
We were screened. There were some other.
You had a dead upper gunner though.
Yeah, we lost one gunner.
One gunner. Yeah.
There were other part crews. And our second squadron commander and his total crew were prisoners of war. He went missing just about the time we were screened, about the time we...
What do you mean screened?
Screened means completing a tour of operations.
Okay, right.
By that time, I had been commissioned my... Pilot had been commissioned. The bomber had been commissioned. I guess the only non-commissioned officer that we had in the crew was our rear gunner, our tail gunner. Oh yes, and our engineer. When we,
by the way, you are now in the Canadian unit.
Yeah.
Presumably your rations were better.
Oh yes, food was much better, and
living.
Accommodation was much, much better. We had moved after we converted to Halifax. We moved to a new station. We went to Middleton St. George.
Oh yes.
And Middleton St. George was a regular RAF base or an RAF station. It's still in existence. I went back to see it about two or three years ago. It's now a civilian airport, but. Regular base. And station at Dalton was what was called a satellite station. It was a satellite of a larger base called Topcliffe. And it was a Nissen hut kind of environment, nothing very fancy. As most of the flying bases were, except for the permanent force bases.
Oh, yeah. No, Larry Dunlap was at Leaming, that's one. He was group commander, group captain at Leaming.
Well, Larry Dunlap later came to join us at Middleton St. George when I came back to Middleton St.
George
the second time. In 1944, and Larry was there as an air commodore, an acting air commodore, I believe. Yeah. Middleton St. George is a very fine base. We enjoyed it there very much. I don't know whether Larry was at Middleton when we had a 4,000 pounder explode on takeoff. Or he may not have been. No, I don't think he was, because this was one of our Wellingtons.
He was only there in early 43, a very short time.
Yeah. Well, we used to carry 4,000-pound bombs in Wellington. We took the bomb doors off. The 4,000-pounder just fitted into the bomb bay and extended outside. In other words, you couldn't close the bomb bay. And that was all the airplane could carry.
Yeah,
it was a hell of a big load for Wellington. And one of our crews was taking off on a mission one day and lost control on takeoff. And the bomb went off as well, which delayed things for a while.
Guess there wasn't a hell of a lot left, eh?
No. A hell of a big hole at the end of the runway. I don't know. There were interesting experiences, I suppose. Many of the trips. Half the time you wondered whether you would ever make it back, not only through enemy action, but also because of weather and inadequacies of navigation equipment. In the early days, the first few trips, I guess. The only navigation aids one had available was wireless or astronavigation. Other than dead reckoning, which doesn't do very much for you unless your winds are the weather people are able to give you predictions that are accurate. Most often in Europe at that time of the year, as you know, it's pretty cloudy. Flying at altitudes where you can't see the ground, so pinpointing is not something that you can rely upon. So essentially, you're relying on your astro-navigation. And if your calculations were accurate, then you managed to navigate back home. I guess that's why I say I wonder often whether some of the crews that went missing weren't missing because they simply weren't able to find the way home. Ran out of fuel somewhere over the North Sea, somewhere in the Quag, and that was it. We had some interesting experiences that way. I remember a little later on, we were assisted by radar development. There was a development called G, which in essence gave you two radar signals which would intersect in a fix, and you're able to fix your position. This was very useful when it first came out. The Germans didn't seem to have the ability to jam it and weren't quite aware of what was required to jam it. That didn't last very long. It was simply a matter of a couple of months, and the Germans were able to jam it very views it up to the coast of France, or just off the coast of Germany or Holland, and then it would be of no use to him. But I can recall on one trip coming back from somewhere, I guess it might have been one of the rare trips, getting a G fix and transposing it inaccurately, and then persisting with that error. Came to where we thought Middleton St. George was and called up, and no such thing as Middleton St. George. But we did hear a friendly voice. We came into land and we found we were way up in Scotland. But it was one of the most fortunate things that happened to us. We landed in very clear weather, where all of our aircraft that did return had to be diverted because we were fogged in. Man didn't have the fuel to divert, so there were aircraft littered all over Yorkshire that night, and we just sort of lucked out by a mistake that I made.
Yeah.
We flew right into good weather and had enough gas to get in without any discovery.
There certainly wasn't any oversupply of gas, was there, in these aircraft? Because
well,
very often you got back with damn little enough.
But the problem was, you see, that you couldn't. You had to sacrifice gas for bomb load. And it was a very closely calculated thing. And I know something about this because later on I became a base nav officer and I was privy to that kind of calculation, just how you worked out the planning for a raid. And you had to take those chances. You gave the crews enough fuel to get there and back under ordinary circumstances. Of course, what you couldn't calculate was the kind of activity they might be involved in, an evasive action, trying to get away from a fighter. You expend a hell of a lot of fuel. You're accelerating, you're changing direction, you're climbing. You might spend a good deal more fuel than you would calculate in planning the trip.
Well, now, how far would, say, 500 pounds of fuel take you in one of the four-engine aircraft? Not really far, I guess.
Oh, gosh. I wouldn't, I would.
I mean, if it came down to the point we're going to put another 500-pounder on or another 1,000-pounder on there, what?
Well, you'd have to make that decision, whether to risk the... You always gave the crews enough to get there and get back under normal circumstances. If something abnormal happened to the crew during the trip, they were in trouble. In other words, quite often the map predictions were very wrong. There'd be a very strong headwind coming back. You would expect perhaps a light headwind or perhaps maybe an assist from the wind. But you'd run into a weather situation where you might have headwinds going and coming.
Yeah.
And you'd use a heck of a lot more fuel than you expected.
Let me put it to you this way. If you were heading for a target and you calculated the fuel necessary to get there and back, and supposing it just came over the point where you could not load another bomb on board, supposing, for example,
would you take the risk of loading that bomb?
Or would you, supposing you had 800 pounds worth of petrol you could put in there, would you load the bomb or load them up with petrol?
I think you'd load them with petrol because you'd want that aircraft to come back.
Yeah, I wonder how you look at this problem.
Not just because of the crew, but because you wanted that aircraft to do that raid again.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted to be able to use the aircraft again because the aircraft or crews were certainly not expendable and aircraft were not expendable either.
No.
So you'd have to use your common sense there, but obviously you'd want the aircraft to crew back.
So you'd top up with petrol, and if there was any...
There was no deliberate, certainly not to my knowledge, no sort of deliberate...
Saving of petrol. No.
Now, there have been, and there were raids where one was aware that if you went on this raid, the chances of coming back were very slim.
Because of this
That's right.
Two factions.
Berlin.
Two factions.
Berlin is a case in point, where you were briefed that it was a touch and go operation. It was a hell of a long way to go, and you could very well end up in a situation where you wouldn't have enough petrol left. You might get back to the UK, but you'd have to rely upon the weather situation being such that you could get in immediately. This was very often the case, you see, particularly in Yorkshire. We would come back to weather that was fine granite. It would be right on the deck. You couldn't land anywhere. There was no place to go.
No. And your navigational equipment for blind landings in those days, I guess, wasn't very sophisticated, was it?
No.
Or did you have any at all?
We didn't have any at all.
Yeah.
Well, later on, we had great assistance from the H2S, which was a radar equipment, the pre-runner, I guess, of television. It gave you a sort of a television picture of the ground, of the terrain. And when we finally got that, I think that saved an awful lot of lives.
What was the limit, visibility limit, for a bomber like a Lang coming in? At that speed, what could you land in safely, or even unsafely?
I suppose you'd land safely maybe at a quarter of a mile, but if you could see anything at all, you'd make a whack at it, because the alternative was to bail out. Nobody wanted to bail out.
Again, because of the lack of fuel, you couldn't digress to another 200 miles.
That's right.
Miles
That's right. And very often you find in the UK when the weather is bad in Yorkshire, it's probably bad all the way down south as well. But the alternatives were few. But the only areas that might be open would be those further north. Quite often Scotland was open when it was flagged in other areas. Now, later in 43, they developed what was called FIDO, which was a land... landing assist program. They simply burned kerosene to burn off the fog along the runways, and this gave you enough visibility to make an emergency landing. Now, FIDO air drones were those recovery air drones on the East Coast. Air drones like Manston had long runways. And
How did they burn off? Did they... long troughs or pots or what do they have to use?
Pots. Yes,
yeah. Must have
been
a hell of a lot of them.
A hell of a lot of kerosene was burned in a FIDO operation. And it was expensive, because this was something that they could ill afford to waste, I guess, or use in this way. But, and that's why they concentrated it at these, I think there were three of these recovery aerodromes. The one I'm familiar with is Manson, because it's the one we use to help with. But we did recover, I suppose, in 30 operational trips, we probably recovered away from base half the time.
Yeah.
Simply because of weather at base.
You picked up the next day and went home, did you?
Yeah. We'd more often than not recover somewhere either very far down south or up north. And
must have been a hell of a lot of aircraft in the same boat. Given night.
Oh, sure.
And how did you... You didn't have a flight plan. How did you... You must have been an awful lot of people blundering around.
There'd be a hell of a lot of people in the circuit at one time.
Yeah.
And you wonder often... I've often wondered why the hell we didn't run into each other, because a lot of the circuits in southern England were... interlocking circuits, the air drones was
tight,
the damn close.
Tight.
Yeah. And in fact, I recall another occasion where we recovered from raid, and then we were getting instructions to land from this one base, and we landed at the one next to it.
Oh,
you know, they were that close.
Yeah.
And we thought we were that was the circuit we were in. I thought I was quite proud of my navigation. I got him there, and he got into the wrong circuit.
I'm sorry, how tight was the ground control? I suppose without a lot of radar and stuff, it was pretty difficult to...
Well, it was all voice control.
Voice control,
yeah.
So
Well, he really didn't know where the aircraft was. He couldn't see him.
No, you just assumed that you were talking to him on your frequency.
Yeah,
and therefore
he found you.
Yeah.
Close enough to.
Yeah. And depending on the weather, he might see the aircraft lights. You know, it depends on how much clouds are around. Well, they did. The ground people did a miraculous job. It was always heartening to come back from a raid to find your ground crew waiting for you, with people who looked after your aircraft. In those days, they had crews assigned to each aircraft, and the ground crew were as proud of your accomplishments and your particular air crew as you were. And they would be there in the early hours of the morning, sometimes 4, 3, 4, or 5 o'clock in the morning, waiting for you in the dispersal area. Had been up all night, presumably, I guess, wondering whether the aircraft was going to come back. Mm-hmm. It was a very close relationship. I think one that probably we don't see. Ground and the air crews work as a fully integrated team, very conscious of what they're about. And we used to socialize to a degree as well. In other words, we'd take the ground crew out for a beer, whatever, celebration of some sort, whatever the celebration was about, whether it was after our 10th trip or after a particularly bad one. Or whatever the occasion might be. So you felt all part of the action, like the person tuning up your engine and putting your bombs on felt as responsible for what occurred as you did, dropping the bombs over the target.
So there was quite an esprit de corps in this small group.
Yeah. Very much so. Yeah.
Sort of a vertical esprit de corps rather than a lateral. You didn't
That's
feel
right.
the same way to
yeah.
your... the other people to the same extent.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a much, much closer relationship in this whole group who were involved with this one aircraft carrying out its particular mission.
What happened at the end of when you came back from a mission? Presumably you arrived home in one piece and hadn't written off your aircraft, but a normal land to carry, normal sort of...
Well, what happened after that was that we would come in and be debriefed by the intelligence officers.
As a crew.
Normally,
one officer, one crew, sort of idea? Or?
One officer, one intelligence officer to one crew.
Okay.
Normally addressing most of his comments to the navigator or the pilot.
Yeah.
The navigator knew
where
he'd been.
Yeah.
In other words, managed the trip.
Yeah.
And they used the navigator's log as the base for questions. The navigator keeps a detailed log of everything that has happened during the trip, all of the courses that have been flown, the heights that have been flown, the speed, when the bombs were dropped, and what the target looked like, and all of that sort of thing. In other words, the full details of the trip were contained in that log. And the intelligence officer would simply question you based on that information and any other information other crew members would volunteer. For example, if you were in a particularly bad flak situation over the target, they'd be very interested in the kind of flak that was exploding, what the color of the bursts were, and what heights, how many aircraft seemed to be hit, and how many were going down in flames, and this sort of thing. What the target looked like, what kind of fires, what the colors of the, whether there was a lot of smoke, whether it was black, they would also ask a good deal from the crew regarding fighter tactics, whether the fighters attacked from down below, whether they came in from above, behind, whatever, whether they used spotlights. In many cases, fighters would come in pairs. One would have a light and another one would come in sort of hoping not to be seen from down below. decoy. I think one of the nice features of the interrogation, I guess, after a mission was that usually the intelligence officers always had a tot of rum for the crew.
Yeah, I guess so.
That always came in handy.
Yeah.
It was rather a thorough debriefing by
this
the
This was right after.
Officer.
This was
right
after. Early hours of the morning.
Yeah.
Be done.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Before you did anything.
Yeah.
You simply got out of your aircraft into a van and straight to the debriefing. You would be debriefed not only by the intelligence officer, but the navigator would also be debriefed by the base nav officer, the senior navigation officer. They're more from a technical point of view to get some idea of navigation problems, of the weather situations in that particular target area, and so on. So it add to the general knowledge.
After that, when he was finished, you trickled off to breakfast or supper or whatever it happened to be.
Yeah,
whatever your schedule was.
Here again, I guess it depended on a hell of a lot of things. There were times we'd have wakes. If a lot of crews were missing, we'd simply go over to the mess and open the bar. The bar would be open.
And
it'd be a bit of a wake. And then we'd get around to having breakfast. Very often it turned into that sort of a situation. It depended much to a great extent, I suppose, on the crews and how close you were to each other.
Now this was breakfast you had at this time.
Oh yeah, it was always breakfast.
You were back on a normal breakfast.
Oh,
sort of meal after you came back.
Oh,
yeah. Right,
yeah. Oh, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, the catering organization, even if you were late or early, was it late on a certain time, or was it always available whenever you were ready for it?
It was always there when we were expected back.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
They would always have breakfast. Yeah. There's a very close relationship between crews in squadrons as well, because We very often took leave together. We were given a few days off every few weeks, simply to get a little relief, I guess, from the tensions of constantly flying. And we'd very often go off on leave together, two or three crews together, and perhaps stay in the same place in bed and breakfast places or wherever we stayed. And so there was it was quite a shock when you lost those those friends, those pals that you've been out with the day before, and come back from the particular trip that you're on. So very often, I guess, coming back bit of a wake and then breakfast and then into bed and then waiting to see whether you'd be going the next night again.
How long you would then go to bed? Would you be up around 1 or 2 in the afternoon? When was your briefing for the next...
You'd normally have to come in by perhaps shortly after lunch hour that afternoon. And you'd have to collect in your particular area. There was a navigation area. There was a bombing shop. There was a wireless shop and so on. To meet with the senior nav officer or the senior bombing instructor or the flight commander, in the case of the pilot, to obtain briefings on the latest situation. You'd get some indication then whether there might be a trip or not. If there was not going to be one, you would hear fairly early in the afternoon that there's a stand down today. And that meant you can go off the base.
didn't actually get 8 hours sleep.
No.
But of course, I think what you have to recognize, you're young and you're hyped up about things. I suppose you'd drop off to sleep for 3 or 4 solid hours, and that'd perhaps be enough.
Well, this would eventually take its toll, of course.
Time. And I think probably that's why tours were cut off at about 30 trips. And then you were given a year's rest normally before you went on another tour. Well, years. 6 months. You were off for several months anyway before contemplating another tour.
was it possible, Gorbo? Well, it must have been quite possible. You somebody would be off
several
for some
days.
Period of time.
Oh, yes. The weather might be bad. We might be going through a refit of some sort. There might be a new piece of equipment being fitted on the whole fleet.
Yeah.
And our squadron might be stood down for a period of 2 weeks.
Yeah.
In those cases.
About 30 missions, if you will, in 6 months, aren't we?
That's right.
Yeah.
So what they would do in that case, they might send you on leave, or you might be sent away on a course. There might be some new piece of equipment you should learn about. A new bomb sight that you have to learn how to handle. I mentioned two kinds of radar equipment that were introduced during that period. We had to learn how to operate. So there were those things that had to take place.
Did you ever get a rather consistent period when you were flying operations, several days in a row, for example?
Yeah, in the in the spring of 1943, we did about 10 trips in succession.
Oh,
I don't think that we had more than a couple of days off in between. It was a time when they were trying to, the idea was to blast Germany into submission, that we would destroy their industrial capacity. And we simply went day after day, night after night. And I think after a while you begin to live on sort of nerve. You're not getting very much rest because you're still reliving the last experience when the next one is upon you. So it all becomes a sort of a blur.
Not much activity within a 2 week period, so it must have been a pretty hefty.
That was the most intense period.
Yeah. So in other ways, the rest of the time, then you normally count on a day or two three off between.
Yeah. And sometimes, as you say, it might be as long as a couple of weeks, two or 3 weeks off, depending on what was happening to the squadron.
Mm-hmm.
We had a good period of time off when we converted from the Wellington to the Halifax. And then just as we were finishing, there was a further conversion program to Lancasters. That was never completed.
It was never completed?
No, because that, our squadron continued on Halifax through the, right through to 45, I guess.
Oh, really? What
some of the other squadrons converted to Helena to Lancasters.
What were your impressions of the relative merits of the Halifax and the Lanc?
Well, the Lancaster was a sort of state-of-the-art aircraft, I guess, at the time. It was carried a larger bomb load, had better performance. The Halifax was the workhorse of our command. I suppose, and in total tonnage, carried more tons than any other aircraft. It was a reliable aircraft. It didn't have quite the service ceiling or the maneuverability of a Lancaster, particularly the Lancs that were finally built in Canada, and we put radial engines. Formed like a fighter when it was empty.
Yeah.
Whereas the Lancaster.
as an aside here, funny enough, they didn't keep any of those radial engine Lancasters, did they? After the war, the Air Force had were the
they were the original.
In line.
That's right, the original Lancaster.
Yeah, I don't know what the reason for that decision was.
I really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
The radial engine came in right at the end of the war, and I suppose the production must have been a very limited production. It was experimental. I recall one squadron, was it 426 that were converted? There was one squadron at Linton, I think, that was converted to the radial engine like. And I guess the war was just coming to a close, and perhaps they simply shut off the production. I really don't know why they. And maybe they decided in the post-war period it would be easier to maintain the inline engine rather than because of the spares that would be available. They were in mass production after all.
Yeah.
Maybe that was the reason. No doubt about it, the radio had the performance edge.
Hmm. And did you ever fly one? Or?
I flew in one.
Did
Yeah. I was instructing at a place called Eastmore after I did. Completed the tour bombs, and we converted. This was what was called a heavy conversion unit. They were the units where you converted from a twin-engine aircraft to a four-engine aircraft. And I was an instructor. Mm-hmm.
Can you hear me gurgling? I must be lunch.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to have to go anyway.
Okay. Well, we're virtually finished. That's fine. And the next time, I'd like to. To pick up in September 43 or October, whenever you finish your tour, and
all right,
where you go from there, if
we'll
that's all right
there.
With you.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much.
What I'll